So I got a fun talk today. One of the things that I think we're so fortunate to have is that, you know, we're building off of a great academic tradition, but we're also building off the work of particularly great men. Louis von Mises and Murray Rothbard both were not simply satisfied kind of deal with the purely abstract and theoretical. I mean, both were men of action in terms of trying to engage meaningfully within politics in ways to actually bring about a world that more closely aligns with their ideological understanding of what a free and prosperous society looks like. And so one of the more controversial aspects of Rothbard's political strategy in particular was his embrace, his understanding of the powers of populism as a potential force for good with libertarian circles. I'm gonna flesh out some of the history of populism within the Western, particularly American tradition, identify some of the aspects of the current political environment, look at some of the criticisms of populism from other libertarians out there, and then kind of outline what I think offers some particularly interesting opportunities for us as Misesi and Rothbardians in engaging with this current political landscape. So, of course, you know, it goes without saying that, you know, populism has been one of the big catchphrases of kind of political discourse for the last several years. You know, Brexit, you see it with other foreign movements, things like that, right? The question is, you know, what is populism in the first place? You know, because not only do we have it from Donald Trump, but, you know, it's described with Bernie Sanders, kind of left-wing populism. Left-wing populism is typically treated by the media a little more respectably than right-wing populism, which might play a, I'll give you some insight on where the true elites stand. We see it also in a post-Trump age, right? The idea that populism is here to stay within the GOP. And this is not unique to the U.S., of course. You know, populists, if you talk to a lot of Latin American libertarians, for example, they are repelled by the idea of populism because of the experiences of Chavez in Venezuela. But we also saw it with the success of Bolsonaro in Brazil, who actually was able to use his position to put in scholars with Mises Brazil in some positions of power that can't be dismissed out of hand. We also see completely non-ideological populist, this also presents the rising specter of, you know, concerns about liberal democracy in Europe, right? This kind of starts with the Brexit, these nativist sort of rejection of EU policies. But we've also seen non-ideological movements entirely. I mean, this is Armenia. They had an anti-corruption populist movement in 2018, which led to the formation of a non-ideological party as the governing party there. So again, there's nothing ideologically connected to populism. So again, is populism a useful term? Here, we have The Atlantic asking if populism is useless because it's only a negative kind of slur. I think that might portray some of the biases within The Atlantic as an institution. But there are some kind of common factors when we talk about populism. You know, they are, again, it's a non-ideological method. It presents society's political conflicts in an us versus them sort of dynamic, you know, the people versus the out-of-touch elite. This elite aspect is also important because typically the populist critique is not only is there an elite isolated from us, but they are growing increasingly distant from cultural norms of the people. It is usually connected with the rejection of political norms, which is one of the reasons for concern. Oh, you're breaking down constitutional order, illegal institutions that are depended upon for stability. So there's fear that populism leads to disturbances in normal order. And also they typically involve a personality cult. You know, there's a man of action that is kind of the catalyst that the masses rally behind. Joe Salerno himself, kind of following that Rothbardian tradition, has looked at kind of populism as a non-ideological vessel. And again, I think this is reflected a lot within a lot of kind of the libertarian political scholarship, you know, the entire battle of winning hearts and minds. There's interesting literature on the differences between the kind of what's called the Hayekian strategy versus the Rothbardian strategy. So there's a long line of work on this, kind of building on Mises's idea that governments are always grounded upon the popularity of, you know, kind of a perceived legitimacy of the population, right? And so again, if you understand that, then populism is simply kind of a weaponization of the people recognizing how far the state has gone from their interest. So again, looking at the origins of it here, we have Gaius Gracchus, who was one of the two Gracchus brothers. In, you know, before the Caesarian era, you had this major issue where because of, you know, increasingly expansionary Roman wars, since the military was only staffed by Roman citizens that had land, the more the soldiers were away, their families back home ended up having to sell their land holdings, which led to this consolidation of wealth. And so land reform was one of the major issues kind of motivating the populares. The opposite, the elite, were the optimates, who were aligned strongly with the Senate of Rome. Cicero was part of the optimates. Julius Caesar was a populist. Again, this is true, even though, again, there was ideological differences between these two camps. They were not kind of traditional modern political parties. Again, it was questioning on what the structure should be the leading actor in political Roman politics. Earlier today, Ryan McMakin brought the Levellers, which was also kind of a British populist rejection of, in this case, it was the absolutism of Parliament after, during the first British Civil War. But again, what had happened was an increase of literacy amongst the common people, and from there started. They were guided by ideologies of religious tolerance, and an embrace of markets, and kind of the origins of liberalism. Within the U.S. after the Revolution, one of the big populist uprisings was Shays' Rebellion. This itself came from former Revolutionary War veterans recognizing that the state governments were using their collective power to increase their taxes on the citizens, to reward financial speculators with hard money rather than the devalued dollars they were collecting, right? So this led to a Shays' Rebellion. That itself also had a backlash, right? That helped, convince otherwise sympathetic individuals of the need for that constitutional counter-revolution that Patrick Newman brought up earlier this week. Right, so again, there are consequences at times for particularly unsuccessful populist uprisings. Of course, the populist party, to the extent that it existed with how controlled and filtered democracy was in the early American Republic, is best embodied by the Jeffersonians. These anti-federalists, these Republicans, the political organization was a direct reflection of critiques on the Hamiltonian merchant class, right? And so from this, again, they were a reaction to Federalist growth of the government went far beyond these stated constitutional aims. They opposed the First Bank of the United States, which they saw as one of the great distributors of state privilege of specific groups. And their response to this was cutting spending, cutting taxes, abolishing the bank. One of the things I want to kind of highlight is that even though we often think about kind of the great men of history, and there's some validness in that, some of those historical perspectives, these populist movements were not simply one man fighting the man, right? Like here we have John Taylor of Carolina, another figure of Patrick Newman's talk. I'm the first MisesU presenter to be able to quote from Patrick Newman's new book. It is a great one on this issue. But here, you have also literature from other scholars that have highlighted that John Taylor's kind of motivating ethos for his economic policy was directly in rejection of the state privilege of the bank, which they saw as a corruptive influence, and further expanding, the wealth and power of a selected few at the expense of the common man, the yeoman farmer, as well as the idea of the American Revolution itself. Of course, kind of it's interesting. Patrick Newman mentioned this, that the post-Jeffersonian era is really our first uniparty, right? The era of good feelings. We're told that we should celebrate this. This is us transcending this petty partisanship that plagues American politics, right? Of course, as Dr. Newman's lecture highlighted, there was a lot of corruption during this period. We saw the moderation of the Jacksonian line, or the Jeffersonian line, which led to, within this party, the formation of coalitions that were explicitly described themselves as radical Republicans, Martin Van Buren being one of them, but of course, the leader of this was that man of action, Andrew Jackson. I use this photo in particular because it's one of my favorites. Not only is he looking quite fetching here, but the title of this portrait is Andrew Jackson, Defender of Beauty and Booty. It was painted in celebration of his great victory at the Battle of New Orleans. Again, a lot of the platform here is very similar, right? Here we have an out-of-touch growing elite benefited by the state privilege of the national bank built-up of, again, a lot of very interesting economic thinkers, such as William Gouge here, who recognized, again, this central institution as the center hub of corruption in American politics and, again, the betrayal of the values that America was founded upon. Gallagher is another one of those figures that I really like in Patrick's book because, again, you know, when you think about American economists prior to the 20th century, you know, sometimes we'll think about Alexander Hamilton, because all of the great economic theorists, right, the ones actually trying to understand how markets act, you know, they were newspapermen. They were politicians. They were not, you know, in universities because that system hadn't been built yet, you know, properly, you know, in the European mold within America. And so these sort of figures that offer a lot of very interesting literature kind of go overlooked. Gallagher in particular, he wrote a book about the Piper money in the United States that was, you know, widely dispersed in Europe. So again, like, this is a very interesting sort of proto-Austrian tradition in a lot of regards that offers some interesting intellectual rabbit holes to go down if you're interested in this topic. Of course, you know, one of the great victories of American history is Jackson's defeat of the bank. I particularly love, like, you've got this demon guy over here, which I think is a proper embodiment of the Second Bank of the United States. One of the great organizers behind Jackson, of course, was Martin Van Buren, one of Murray Rothbard's favorite presidents, who was a brilliant man. He was the son of a tavern keeper, you know, ended up building one of the most powerful political parties of his age. He had one great weakness, though: trains that looked like William Henry Harrison. It's funny, in this case, and Rothbard brings up this point, that the populism of Jackson was kind of trumped by the populism of William Henry Harrison, which was very superficial. Right, he himself was a member of kind of an elite class, but they kept him out of the campaign. They made these, you know, they pushed this propaganda with the newspapers about how, like, he's just a simple old country bumpkin that likes a sip on his hard cider, the great, you know, victor of Tippecanoe, and bringing with him Tyler too. Of course, unfortunately, shortly thereafter, American politics becomes defined by the American Revolution, by the American Civil War, and then you have the rise of the Lincoln administration. And with it, again, not quite a central bank, but you have the greenbackers, you have the greenbacks, and you know, financial regulations that end up again creating some of the big issues here. Even more telling, though, is that if you think about this period of history, it's something we don't think about a lot. Here you had, after the Civil War, an America with states literally occupied by federal troops, right, a post-Civil War South. And within that, you also have the growing railroad industry, which is one of the most politicalized industries in American history because of its dependence upon land grants, right? This Republican Party was perhaps the most corrupt, destructive party in American history, not simply because of, you know, a revisionist views in the Civil War itself as a conflict, because in theory, right, in theory, you could roll back some of these extravagances of war if you really value the Union, right? There's a narrative for that out there. The problem is that they weren't quite content with, there was no interest in rolling back, right? You started the rise of American empire. One of the great conflicts within this, you know, a post-Civil War America, you had the rise of another very interesting, overlooked, free market populist tradition, which is called the Bourbon Democrats. You know, these are consisted of Southerners that rejected post-Civil War policy, but also led by a man named Sam Tilden, who was the governor of New York. He was a great victor over Boss Tweed, which is kind of one of the most nefariously corrupt figures of New York history, which is probably, you know, the state of the Union with the most extravagant history of corruption, right? But this entire tradition, again, went back to this Jacksonian era of railing against the central bank, promoting sound money as the surest way of tackling a lot of this corruption that was very apparent in the system. The problem is that at this point, the structures have become so powerful that literally the election of 1876, the night of the election, everyone understood that Sam Tilden had defeated the governor of Ohio, Rutherford Hayes. But that's not quite how it worked out. The election was stolen. It was stolen in part because of a New York Times op-ed. At that time, it was a very partisan Republican paper. It kind of helped sow a confusion about the results on election night that helped Ulysses S. Grant to mobilize federal troops to occupy ballot boxes. Tilden's camp was said, hey, look, if you give us money, we'll give you the votes that you need. He was one electoral vote short. He refused to do it because it was his view that, hey, look, I'm running to clean up this corruptive state fueled by these financial interests. And see, this is what they want me to do. They want me to compromise before just to get what I've already won. He rejected it. Well, he rejected it at his own peril. We did have the rise of Hayes. The interesting thing about that, this bargain, one of the aspects of it was that you removed federal troops from the South, but you also got, in return, the Democratic Party was allowed to appoint the Postmaster General, which is where all the spoils was at. So again, it turns out the Democratic Party didn't really care about corruption. They simply wanted it to be their own corruption. Because of this, the Republican Party controlled American politics for 24 years. Think about how much power that came with that move right there. Of course, shortly thereafter, you have a breakup of what is a third political system, which was kind of the way it's looked in through political science literature. One of the most interesting articles on this period is actually in the Progressive Era book, looking at this very unique tradition. Again, another Patrick Newman point he made in his lecture yesterday was about the Pietists and the liturgicals. Murray Rothbard goes a lot in depth on that with his Progressive Revolution, or Progressive Era book. And of course, when we think about populism in the U.S., you know, often it's William Jennings Bryan that is kind of seen as one of the great examples, right? He had the Populist Party. The idea of, you know, minting silver was seen as a way of bailing out indebted farmers. But what's interesting here is that the William Jennings Bryan taking over the Democratic Party changed fundamentally the ideological structure. Right? This is what kind of led to kind of the modern uniparty that has kind of controlled American politics maybe until the Trump era, of two interventionist, regulated free market parties. And again, and Rothbard, within a variety of works dealing with this period of history, like, he talks about how this was destructive of the laissez-faire tradition within mainstream American politics. I think one of the most interesting aspects about this, and something that Rothbard brings up, is that even though Jennings is called a populist, what we actually saw, for one, he never won an election, right? So apparently he really did not have the support of the people. But after this change in political systems, we saw a massive decline in electoral participation. And that's one of the kind of the interesting aspects about this Rothbardian populist view, is that in some ways it's a mirror opposite of some like the neo-reactionary, anti-democracy sort of literature, you know, out there in the conservative movement today. It is from this perspective that it was the decreased interest of the masses in politics that actually helped allow for the larger consolidation of state power. And again, we're gonna look at some other trends in the present day, but again, I think this is something that's very interesting here. Of course, the other great populist of American history is kind of the polar opposite of Andrew Jackson. You have Teddy Roosevelt. Both of them have, I think, very important features aesthetically that explains why they continue to be celebrated figures today. The biggest thing is that they're macho, right? If populism relies upon the man of action, the strong man, Teddy Roosevelt certainly had that in spades. But what's interesting is that even though he sold as this great trust buster, if you look at the actual history of the Roosevelt administration, which is covered, there's two great short reads on this from Rothbard, The Origins of the Federal Reserve and something about the Federal Reserve, Wall Street, and foreign policy. He really goes down into the connections of how Teddy Roosevelt was a longtime ally of J.P. Morgan, you know, one of the great trusts out there. And again, you see this throughout Murray Rothbard's work of this era, is that he identifies all of the large corporate powers that be. You have the Morgan family versus the Rockefeller family. Again, this plays a very prominent role in kind of the creation of the Federal Reserve. And so again, if you're interested in this period of history, there's a lot of very interesting literature kind of naming names and this power elite sort of analysis. Of course, when we think about populism now, again, as I mentioned, what's interesting is that, you know, 20th century politics was defined by kind of the uniparty, a decline in average people being engaged in the system. And that changed to a large degree with Donald Trump. And one of that is because of him doing right there, right? Not only was he a billionaire celebrity reality TV star, but he was perhaps the most interesting account on Twitter. But of course, within the kind of the Trump wave, you've seen rises of other figures advocating for right-wing populism, such as Steve Bannon, and also Tucker Carlson, right? And of course, you know, what's interesting is if you look at the change in demographics of the Republican electorate, what we saw was a massive decline of support from Republicans amongst like college-educated white voters, the country club crowd that had long been kind of recognized as synonymous with the GOP. And in its return, we had kind of this working-class, blue-collar coalition. And we saw this reflected, I mean, I think it was one of the last rallies that Donald Trump did in 2020, this massive attendance rising from the masses. And again, we saw this play out. I can't really see this here. As the title of this graph shows, the 2020 voter turnout is estimated to be the highest in 120 years. So again, this goes back, like this, we're now reverting back to a previous political system in terms of electoral engagement with the population. And I think this is interesting, particularly considering that, you know, regardless of your thoughts about who actually won the presidential race, it is unquestionable that down the line, the GOP did remarkably well in congressional races, state house races. The Senate was a little bit of an interesting thing. In theory, the increase of the voting population was always seen as a way of Democrats gaining even greater power, but obviously that did not happen in spite of, again, 120-year highest voter turnout. So, of course, all this that we've seen Donald Trump, I'm sure I don't have to tell you guys here, has created a lot of negative press by certain institutions, right? You know, this alongside populist movements within Europe, within South America, right? Bolsonaro was described as the Trump of the tropics. You know, you have all of the expected institutions of the regime, such as the Brookings Institute, identifying that populism is the threat of liberal democracy, which, given the actions of this past year, I find quite interesting. Again, this is not simply Brookingsy. This is the Human Rights Council, right? You see it also from the Adam Smith Institute, which, because of Brexit, I think rebranded itself from libertarianism to what they call neoliberalism. And also we saw from Tom Palmer of the Cato Institute, who's perhaps one of the most vocal opponents of the threat of, you know, the greatest warners of the threat of populism in American politics. And within this article, he makes the similar point that the Brookings Institute made, right? That this brand of populism that we're seeing emerge, that it threatens individual liberty, free markets, the rule of law, constitutionalism, the free press, and liberal democracy. Now, who here actually thinks we have any of these things? Right, they take at face value the propaganda of the state. There is nothing liberal about, you know, a society that deplatforms political dissidents and that beats political prisoners because of a rally and the events of January 6th, right? And there's nothing democratic about a society where we see corporate, labor, national security agencies all conspiring for a specific a political outcome and changing election law unconstitutionally right before. You don't change the rules of a game and then expect people to take the game seriously, right? The biggest threat to all these institutions is not populism, but it's the actions of the technocrats that are doing everything they can to stop, that are worried about this populist uprising that we've just seen in electoral behavior. And what's also interesting in this is, again, it's populism is a big threat, but yet, if you look at Cato content about Ron DeSantis and his actions this past year, you've got five articles. Most of them are criticizing him because the real danger is government getting in the way of vaccine passports. They're criticizing him for big tech issues. There's no, oh man, like think about how much liberty we saved because one state, because a state like Florida of that size and that population stood against the tyranny of the technocrats this past year. Telling, I think. Lou Rockwell has a term for the sort of libertarian like Tom Palmer. He calls him the regime libertarian. The regime libertarian believes in the market economy more or less, but talks about the Federal Reserve or Austrian business cycle theory gets him fidgety. His institute would rather invite Janet Yellen for an exclusive cocktail event rather than Ron Paul for a lecture. It's too tough to be a libertarian when it comes to anti-discrimination law, given how much flack he's liable to get, and he'll side with left liberals on that, even though it's completely incompatible with libertarian principles. He sips in happy concord with supporters of the most egregious unjust wars, but his blood boils in moral outrage at someone who told an off-color joke 25 years ago. I think we can add to this that, you know, that the regime libertarian would rather be published in Bloomberg and the New York Times in defense of lockdowns rather than be skeptical of the narrative here. To be fair, though, to Mr. Palmer, though, his concerns are not simply about this protection of liberal democracy. The real threat is often perceived as a war on pluralism. The idea here that, you know, it is the populism allows for a certain portion of the group to wield this political power against minority groups. This can be seen in view of minorities, financiers, et cetera, right? The 1%. Well, one of the things I think is interesting is that if we're trying to identify what might be that minority group of elites, they're imposing their will on the people that should be rejected against. There's a very interesting study. It's kind of a transcends typical left-right binary views. It's called Hidden Tribes. One of the things I really like about this, it highlights like how much political correctness and cultural issues are motivating non-white voters, which I think goes against, again, the narrative that we're often told. And here you see 8% is labeled as progressive activists. And it's these progressive activists that have outsized power in the institutions of the current regime. You can't really see from there, but you know what you see is that there is the majority are not proud of American history. The majority, I can't really read from there, but what you see is that these are very striking views held by this population, and they're views that are not typically held by other groups, even other traditional Democratic voters within this research. Compared to average Americans, they're twice as likely to list politics as a hobby. You know, they're the sort of people that never give up Twitter. They're more likely to be white. They're more likely to be college graduates or in postgraduate programs, right? So this is, I think, the demographic that if you're identifying like, what really is an ideological demographic that has outsized power in the current system, I think that there's some very interesting analysis highlighting specific institutional power. And of course, one of the things about the Trump age is there's a lot of stories about the parallels between kind of the Trump brand and Pat Buchanan's wing in the early 1990s. And I think there's some reasons for this politically. The 90s were defined by kind of post-Cold War foreign policy. That kind of helped split up like the typical Republican coalition of anti-communist hawks, free marketeers, and cultural conservatives. Because if there is no Cold War menace, then again, that's one big part of that three-legged stool that might not be needed anymore. And so from that, you saw Pat Buchanan, who's considered kind of a paleoconservative, an anti-empire conservative with some questionable economics views. But what you had was the establishment of institutions designed for dialogue with the paleoconservatives and what became known as paleolibertarians. Paleolibertarians were the fountainhead of that school of political tradition. It was Murray Rothbard and Lou Rockwell here. There was a creation of a number of institutions for this regard. You had the Rothbard-Rockwell report. There was a creation of the John Randolph Society, named from Patrick Newman's favorite Virginian politician, that had members of both paleocons and paleolibertarians. Pat Buchanan himself was a member. And so what's interesting, I think, is that if we're trying to identify how we as libertarians might be able to take advantage of this current political environment, we should look at the past. So here, one of my favorite articles, again, if you're interested in this topic, the first one you start off with is an article called Strategy for the Right. In addition to converting intellectuals to the cause, Murray Rothbard said, the proper course for the right-wing opposition must necessarily be a strategy of boldness and confrontation, of dynamism and excitement, a strategy, in short, of rousing the masses from their slumber and exposing the arrogant elites that are ruling them, controlling them, taxing them, and ripping them off. There's an article recently by Ryan McMakin that kind of expanding this point a little bit, the idea being that economics is a key tool in the culture war. You know, there's a lot of economists that kind of want to transcend. Like, and you see this also very. You saw this with Dr. Block last night, right? You know, his description of libertarianism was neither left nor right. There are some libertarian scholars or some economists that don't like getting into those left-right cultural dynamics. But Murray Rothbard and I, you see this reflected also in the work of Lou Rockwell. Like, they recognized that one of the best ways to get our ideas out there in the general population is by appealing to cultural preferences and highlighting how the free market does not destabilize the family, does not destabilize churches, does not destabilize these institutions that conservatives value, but instead complement them. It's important to realize, Rothbard went on, that the establishment doesn't want excitement in politics. It wants the masses to continue to be lulled to sleep. It wants kinder, gentler. It doesn't want a Pat Buchanan, not only for his excitement and hard edge of his content, but also for a similar tone and style. I wonder if there's a modern American politician that this sort of description might apply to. Again, I think it's precisely the tone and the excitement of Donald Trump that end up elevating, again, some of these electoral trends that we've seen in the past couple of years. So again, paleolibertarianism as a libertarian coalition guided by the ideas of Mises and Rothbard, they identified some specific points that the Leviathan state is the institution of evil throughout history, that it is the free market that defends moral and practical institutions, that private property is an economic necessity as well as a moral one. That part in particular I think is important because often capitalism is defended kind of on purely materialistic grounds, right? You see this critique often come up like the populace right now, is that, oh, well, you know, libertarians will sell out their grandma for, you know, a couple extra points on GDP, right? No, we're not simply interested in the creation of stuff for the sake of stuff. This stuff is very important, right? It's very easy to take for granted modern living conditions, but it's because precisely that free markets are morally strong institutions beyond simply material gains. I think relevant with some of the growing inward turn from the kind of, we see the tools of the war on terror now being the war on domestic terror, kind of goes through the threats of the garrison state, kind of the use of the FBI within trying to prosecute Republicans and red states around the country, Again, also explicitly anti-welfare state as a way of that, you know, victimizes not only the producers and the small businesses of the country, but also it's detrimental to the clients, the receivers of welfare. Again, a lot of this stuff is kind of libertarian stuff, but they combine with the cultural norms, a defense of Western civilization, the defense of Christian values, you know, defense of family, church, state, et cetera. And again, I think it's precisely the cultural outreach here that offers this as an opportunity to build coalitions. One person who was very effective at this is, you know, is obviously Congressman Dr. Ron Paul. In 96, Congressman Paul had been out of Washington for quite a while. You know, he ran for the LP in 88. He got reelected in Texas in 1996, in spite of harsh opposition by the GOP establishment. Newt Gingrich was, you know, flying down there trying to target this election in particular to stop Dr. Paul, and they couldn't succeed. Everyone knew that Ron Paul was a hardcore libertarian. He wasn't simply a country doctor that had, you know, delivered 4,000 babies at this point, as he was able to kind of get away with in the 70s, right? People knew exactly what he was. And because he was able to build, you know, with the work of Murray and Lou, a much larger network. And you saw this, I think, also play out during his presidential cycles, right? I mean, it was homeschooling moms in Iowa that were as rabid for Ron Paul, you know, as anarchists from here in Auburn, right? And again, it's broadening the power of these ideas. Of course, you know, there's no greater institution right now that I think drives a lot of the critiques that, again, this kind of modern populist movement has on capitalism, as they understand it, than the Fed. Right, this is one of my favorite sites out there for kind of good propaganda purposes is WTF happened in 1971. They've got a great series of charts kind of identifying going off the gold standard as a big breaking point, kind of leading to the rise of the kind of financialization economy that we have right now. You know, that's where we can talk about income inequality, the breakdowns between output and wages. We can talk about differences in real GDP, trade policies, et cetera, like that. We can talk about consolidation of wealth. And what's interesting right now is that for all the critiques out there, you see this with Steve Bannon's, you see this with Tucker Carlson's, they'll rail against the venture capitalists, they'll rail against the chambers of commerce. The one institution that they don't talk about is the Fed. Steve Bannon just was recently on with Tim Pool, another kind of, you know, Occupy Wall Street sort of populist. And he kind of ignored this issue. And again, I think this is one of those opportunities where, again, all of their critiques in society, you know, the critiques about the weathering away of like the one-income household, right? There is a narrative there that we can tell as people, as Rothbardians in our understanding of the way that central banks and credit expansion play a role in the consolidation of power. Of course, you know, we've had some very interesting sort of uprisings within the current financial system, not simply in talking heads on TV, but we see this kind of the use of Wall Street bets as a trading platform, kind of targeting these large financial institutions. And one of the criticisms is the consolidation of corporate power. I think this is relevant not only to the discussion of big tech, which I'm going to touch on here shortly, but kind of just generally, right? And one of the things that, you know, we should be able to understand as Austrians, there's a very interesting paper on this particular topic in 2014, the QJAE, about historical trends of what was called merger waves and corporate consolidation within business cycles. Again, this makes sense, right? You make it cheaper for large corporations to buy up debt or to take on debt. They then use that to acquire competitors, right? You know, Facebook has spent the last decade, you know, acquiring Instagram and WeChat, and, you know, what's that? We have this whole variety of a network, right? Which again leads to further consolidation, which then combined with the attention of Washington ends up leading to this very destructive environment, you know, where the company corporations that benefit the most from state privilege right now, you know, even if they wanted to be good actors here, the danger is that, you know, rejecting censoring Trump supporters, you know, increases the likelihood of penalizing regulations from Washington, D.C. And I think this gets to a very interesting different dynamic in kind of the Republican Party as we see it right now, you know, in this populist era. We have someone like Josh Hawley, who was a senator, and perhaps because of his current position, there is a push for conservatives in power to utilize the weapons of the federal government to deal with, you know, Section 230, to try to use the federal government as a means of breaking up these institutions that they have identified as threats to conservative values here in the U.S. And this is kind of the old Teddy Roosevelt approach to populism, right? It's trust-busting to a certain extent. It's hostile to some corporate interests. But there's always, it's attacking your enemies, but defending your allies. And of course, you know, it's interesting when you look at the backgrounds, the CVs of some of these people in high positions in big tech companies, how often they have been alumni of the Kamala Harris Senate office of Joe Biden's administration, of Barack Obama's administration, right? The alternative to this, though, is kind of the Ron DeSantis approach. You know, the identifying something like big tech as an issue, and then identifying that there is perhaps a role for state governments, independent from that federal framework, to take seriously some of these concerns that conservatives have. One of the things that really frustrates me about this particular issue, and I don't have the answer. There's not a clear answer on how you break up this consolidated wealth. But you have some really bad arguments out there against the DeSantis bill in particular. And I think it stems, this misunderstanding of the difference between the state approach versus the federal approach can be devastating to our cause. Because in this article, whose author is not particularly important, but within it, the comparison being made to justify what is a standard libertarian view, right, that property is he draws the comparison of Facebook to a wall. And now imagine you have this wall that you've built. And people now can draw on your wall. Banksy comes and draws on your wall. But somebody draws something on the wall you don't like. And then you paint it up. And then, oh, this big, bad, authoritarian Ron DeSantis is telling you that you can't have that on the wall. Like, oh, this is an infringement of property. Of course, comparing a wall to big tech misses the point. Like these are not similar goods. Particularly with like the American tradition of political discourse. You know, it's interesting. You've had others kind of say, oh, this is the biggest infringement upon First Amendment rights we've ever seen. The Florida bill in particular kind of focused purely on registered political candidates. And you see this with the way that newspapers, cable companies, cable stations, radio stations, there's always been equal time laws when it comes to political discourse of registered political candidates. Because there's an understanding that in a democracy where elections do matter, that if you allow for one side to control the discourse, there's going to be political consequences that do not lend themselves to that liberal democracy that we're supposed to be intent on conserving, right? So again, there's plenty of issues with the Ron DeSantis approach. Like, the guy that wrote the legislation clearly doesn't understand how algorithms work. Like, you know, I'm not defending this is the ideal libertarian perspective. But ultimately, I think as libertarians engaging in this populist world and dealing with the fact that we're living in an economy with the Federal Reserve giving, among other aspects of federal policy, large, powerful corporations hostile to American interests, state privilege, the very aspect that motivated that 19th century populism, right? We need to engage with it seriously. And as Frederick Bastiat said, the worst thing that can happen to a good cause, such as the cause we are here for, now, it's not to be skillfully attacked, but to be ineptly defended. And again, a lot of commentary on this issue have been ineptly defended. And you know, this is important. This is an issue that matters. I mean, imagine right now what the American empire is. I mean, it's perhaps the most perverse form of empire we've ever seen. Because at least in history's past, empires, you know, expanding territory, you get the tyranny at home, you get expansionism abroad, but there's a certain national pride, you know, right, that came to being a Roman citizen. Here in the U.S., you know, we have an empire that disrupts abroad, that terrorizes us here at home, and yet wants to deprive us of even having pride in the American tradition. And it's precisely because that American tradition is baked in the ideas and the ideology and the populist of classical liberalism that they so hate. One of the other interesting things about this environment is that we're now living in an inflationary, you know, we've seen the last few months inflationary environments, and historically inflation is a very major driver, very influential in politics. We saw protests kind of on this regard. You know, you used to have back protesting interest rate hikes for Paul Volcker. You have people sending like wood in saying like, oh, well, no one's buying houses because of your interest rate policy. So you know, have at it. And this is particularly right now an environment where, you know, luckily a lot of the political discourse out there in an inflationary environment where money really does matter, where spending is an issue, 95% of all political pundits have nothing to say. Right? They've been acting in this economically nihilistic environment for the last several decades. And so this gives us opportunities to identify, again, who the enemy is, what should society look like, and preach sound economic policy to identify how our methods achieve the means that these populists want. I'm going to finish up with two quotes, one from Ludwig von Mises here. Because one of the things that is important here, and you see this throughout kind of Mises' views on ideas in society, right? Going back to that idea of the popular government. He viewed economics as something that should not simply be confined to academics talking about theoretical papers. You know, it should not be isolated to ivory towers. You know, what we need is engagement from the population to understand at least basic economics. If you understand basic economics, you're more economically literate than the experts at the Fed. That's one of the purposes of Mises University, is to help provide a very deep background in this to a variety of different disciplines. But it's also up to us, and you see this throughout the Austrian tradition of engaging with normal people. You know, Henry Hazlitt himself, right, was a journalist. Karl Menger himself was also a journalist, right? Like, we have all these great historical figures that we should recognize, to take from their example. If great movements are typically led by men of action, one of the greatest benefits that we have as Austrians is we have great men that we can emulate. You know, we have Ludwig von Mises. If you haven't got it, download the biography of Ludwig von Mises as a free audio book. It's one of the best things out there. But also Murray Rothbard, right? These are brilliant men who took great personal, who gave up otherwise potentially very lucrative and powerful careers in defense of the ideas necessary for building civil society. And it's precisely because the weaknesses of this current political environment come from an understanding of economics developed by kind of the current public school apparatus that doesn't want you to think like an economist. This makes our role here as people that engage with the political environment all the more important. I'm going to leave you with one of my favorite Rothbard quotes, because I was told to end on a cheering note. This speaks to the fire with which Rothbard did so much of his intellectual work. America as it exists today is two nations. One is their nation, the nation of the corrupt enemy, of their Washington, D.C., of their brainwashing public school system, their bureaucracies, their media. And the other is our much larger nation, the majority, the far nobler nation that represents the older and truer America. We are the nation that is going to win, that is going to take America back, no matter how long it takes. It would indeed be a grave sin to abandon that nation and that America short of victory. Ladies and gentlemen, the Mises Institute is here to make sure that we can do everything we can in pursuit of that victory. Thank you very much.